You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Menopause has been around as long as humans have walked the earth. It's a guaranteed fact of life for half of the population. In recent years, though, talking about this stage of life has become less taboo. But despite the greater spotlight in women's health, understanding menopause and how it can be drastically different from one person to the next is still kind of in its infancy. I mean, it's only been about 30 years since medical research in the United States was required to include women and minorities. So the medical field has a lot to catch up on, and that can translate to barriers in accessing information and treatment. Insurance and denials can be a costly problem for women seeking care. CAP Radio reporter Megan Myskowski has spent the past 6 months understanding the gap in menopause research and treatment. She joins us with the latest part in her series, which also includes legislation working its way through the state capitol that would make menopause treatment more affordable and accessible. This story is part of a series produced for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's California Health Equity Fellowship. Hey, Megan.
Hey, Vicky.
Okay, so you put together a three-part series on menopause. What inspired you to dive into this?
So I followed some legislation last year, and I kind of just thought it was interesting. You know, you don't hear a lot about menopause legislation in general. And then once I started reading up on it and getting into it, I realized we are kind of starting to hear more about it. So that's really what got me to go diving a little deeper. I kind of learned as I was doing this that people are starting to get more comfortable with talking about it, whether it's in their, you know, personal lives or in the legislature. One source that I talked to who's worked on legislation across the country related to periods about a decade or so, you know, she was really involved with the things you're hearing about related to like the pink tax, was saying that this actually right now feels pretty similar to her.
Okay. I mean, menopause is a guaranteed part of life for half of the population, but it still is confusing to navigate, even know that it's happening. It wasn't talked a lot when I was a kid with either like my mom or my grandma. What did you learn about the reasons why?
So yeah, you're right. We really don't talk about it. And there isn't really a whole lot of time devoted in school, for example, to begin with, and not a lot of opportunities to learn about it after that. So that means that most people hear about it from their doctor, and usually when it's already happening. You know, they're feeling symptoms, they go to their doctor, and that's when, you know, a lot of people even learn about what perimenopause is, which is kind of the stage before menopause. One source that I spoke with, Denise Pines, she used to be the head of the California Medical Board and had great insurance and was still completely caught off guard by it. She thought she was actually having a heart attack when she had her first hot flash.
To me, this is a reflection of how people care about women. They don't care about women, and they really don't care about women as you get older.
And she actually went on to make a PBS documentary that came out last year about menopause and sort of this gap in knowledge about it and, it, you know, what's kind of going on with coverage.
So there seems to be gaps in knowledge on an individual, personal level, but from a medical perspective, how much is known about menopause?
That's still also a little bit dicey. So research on women wasn't actually required until the 1990s. Congress passed a law then to that effect. And the more we learn about it, the more we also learn how wide its impact on the body is. So there's really a lot to study kind of from head to toe in people's bodies as they're experiencing this. One of those places is the brain. Hot flashes, for example, start there. A lot of people have brain fog, and it gets very little attention in neurological research. One of the sources that I spoke to, Dr. Emily Jacobs, actually does research on that. And that's exactly what she had to say about it.
I can count on two hands, like the number of big projects that have been done. So it's not that there has been nothing, but relative to other questions, there's such a dearth.
And then doctors are also still relying on old information in some situations. So, for example, there was a study 20 years ago that looked into hormone replacement therapy and found that you know, there could be a higher cancer risk associated with it than people previously thought. So that really scared off doctors and the patients who are reading about it in the news. That made it so that there was a pretty long amount of time, about 20 years, where it wasn't getting prescribed as much, or, you know, it was getting prescribed, but with a lot of caution. Since then,
why would someone take hormone replacement therapy or HRT during menopause?
So one aspect of menopause is that it changes how your body makes and regulates estrogen. And so this helps with that. This helps get estrogen to different parts of your body, which estrogen's actually is pretty involved in a lot of different functions in your body. So since that study, or at least in the last few years, people have been kind of starting to rethink some of the pieces of that study, rethinking, you know, pieces of how it was done and also what the study even kind of says. I've seen some people also say that parts of the study maybe weren't communicated as well as they could have been, and some of the risks maybe sounded bigger, depending on, you know, how you understand the numbers. Denise Pines also spoke to that.
That has been totally rebuked. And of course, now there are so many different hormone replacement therapies, even now non-hormonal replacement therapies.
So what they're saying now is that it really depends on the patient and their medical history. So if you have, for example, a history of breast cancer in your family, maybe your doctor is going to be a little bit more cautious about giving you HRT, but that doesn't necessarily cover everybody. And many doctors and patients are still kind of catching up with that. That's something that's really been talked about more in the last few years. And there's also, you know, not a ton of new information to replace it as well.
Okay, so this study on HRT, hormone replacement therapy for menopause, was 20 years old and hadn't really been updated. So that creates some uncertainty, which can get in the way of treatment to help relieve symptoms of menopause. Do any long-term studies on menopause actually exist, like following someone for years or even decades?
Yeah, there is a few. For example, Dr. Emily Jacobs, who we heard from earlier, the neurologist, she's looking into brain health across women's lifetimes, including this stage of life, menopause. There's also a big one called SWAN, which started with a few thousand women in the mid-90s, and it's actually still going. And that information gets used for a ton of different studies. I think they've published hundreds. They've looked at long-term effects of menopause on people's bodies, but then also things that maybe are a little bit more specific, like vaginal dryness or continency, pretty much anything that comes up in this period of life for people. One of the people that I talked to is actually an administrator on this, so she helps make sure that the participants keep coming for decades.
Each one of them are very unique and important to the project, you know, because it's a longitudinal study and we can't replace them. We want to follow them from the beginning to whenever, to the very end.
That was Elaine Chung, and she works with Kaiser, and she actually works in Oakland. So this study has 7 hubs, including Oakland, across the country, and it focuses on 5 different ethnic groups. And part of her job is also to speak to people in their native language, make them feel comfortable, keep them coming back. And that's really important when you're trying to get people to keep showing up for 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio reporter Megan Myskowski about her series on the lack of research surrounding menopause and the medical field playing catch up. So when you first introduced your series on Insight, you dove into the trend of menopausal related legislation that's taking shape across the country. What does that look like here in California?
So there's not a ton, but still more than most states. There was a bill that was vetoed last year by the governor. It did actually pass the legislature. And there's 2 that have been introduced this year. One already kind of hit the end of the road.
So your latest piece hones in on Assembly Bill 432. What would this exactly do?
So this is the one that's pretty strongly related to the one from last year. In fact, it was written by the same person. So it does a couple of things. It would require some doctors to do training on menopause in order to renew their licenses, depending on how many female patients they see. And it would also require health plans to cover certain treatment. That would include a handful of things like hormone replacement therapy or, you know, treatment for osteoporosis and prevention of osteoporosis. The person who wrote it is Bay Area Democratic Assembly member Rebecca Bauer Cahan. You know, she said that part of the reason she wrote it was that she just kind of looked around and saw people she knew and even herself not getting treatment that they really strongly felt they needed.
We just decided to say, you know what? We're going to say it needs to be covered because we believe it's medically necessary.
So what sparked this bill? I know there was that personal experience from the assembly member, but was there more behind it?
Yeah. So she says it was these personal experiences, getting these texts from friends, and then even her own experience where she says she had brain fog that got so bad that she thought she might have early onset Alzheimer's. She also pointed out that this is a place where there's a dearth of information for many people, not just her and her friends. There's also not a ton of information on access when you're talking about, you know, that insurance piece, access specifically to menopause symptom treatment. For this story, I did talk to a researcher who has done some of that. Her name is Dr. Karen Adams, and she's currently with Stanford. And she contributed to a study recently that looked at healthcare access for women going through menopause. She and her team found that over 60% of people experiencing moderate to severe menopause symptoms weren't receiving any sort of treatment.
We found that it's pretty abysmal all the way across the board, but it's even worse if people are on public insurance or uninsured.
Okay, so 60%, that is a huge chunk of people who are not accessing treatment when they're going through moderate to severe menopause symptoms. So what are the biggest barriers when it comes to accessing reliable treatment for these symptoms?
Insurance denials come up pretty often. Dr. Adams said she and her staff spend a lot of time appealing those, and that's actually pretty common. It's also not guaranteed when they put that work into that that it'll actually pay off. And that leads to many people paying out of pocket for treatment or paying high co-pays, or they just say, I can't afford it, and they go without it.
How serious can it be to go without treatment for menopause symptoms?
Dr. Adams says it can be life-threatening, and that's because some of this treatment is preventative. So, for example, bone health is a big concern during menopause, and there are treatments that can prevent or help address, you know, osteoporosis. But it's like with any preventative care, it does really matter that you start it in a timely way.
What is the status of this bill now?
So the bill cleared the assembly, and it's now in the Senate. So it's still got a little ways to go, but it is moving.
Is this being done elsewhere in the country? Are there similar pieces of legislation in other states?
There are. So there are a couple of bills that have already been signed into law over the last few years. One of them is in Illinois, and that one is pretty specific. It tells insurance companies that they have to cover care for people who have had hysterectomies and are entering menopause early because of that. There's also a bill in Louisiana that passed in the last couple of years that is pretty broad and just tells insurance companies that they have to cover a variety of different care that would address menopause symptoms.
Okay, so when it comes to the bill here in California, you mentioned it's now in the Senate. What are the odds that this becomes a law?
So that's kind of hard to tell. Like I said, there was a bill last year that was pretty similar to Bauer Cahan's bill. She authored a pretty similar one last year, and Newsom vetoed that. This one, in her words, she's doubled down here, so she hasn't necessarily made it more broad or taken too much of a different approach, but she has added to it. So it will be interesting to see what happens. Newsom's office, when I reached out, said they wouldn't comment on the bill, but I think that's pretty common that they don't comment on legislation that's still moving. And then at the same time, it's like we've heard a lot, and like I've been here to talk to you about before, it's a really tight budget year, and the legislature is making some pretty tough decisions, including with healthcare.
Yeah, the money is tight. Is there any opposition to this bill?
Yeah, definitely. The California Association of Health Plans opposes it and many similar bills to it. And that's because it restricts plans from using prior authorization. That is where insurance companies require providers like doctors to submit for approval for individual treatments.
So is prior authorization, is this a common practice in healthcare?
It is, and it's gotten more common over the years as healthcare costs continue to rise and plans are looking for ways to, you know, bring down the amount that they're spending. I talked to Garen Corbett, who's the director of the California Health Benefits Review Program at UC Berkeley.
It's this, you know, part and parcel of this long-term struggle of, like, how do you provide broad access and maintain affordability when no one really has more than part of the levers to control.
So he's saying that legislators can only control certain aspects of this and that they're trying to figure out how to work with, you know, where they can to bring down costs.
So it seems like these challenges go beyond menopause.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's reflected in other legislation that's moving through the California legislature right now. There's a handful of bills pretty similar to this that would regulate prior authorization. There's one that would say that plans can't do this for HIV/AIDS treatment. There's another one for insulin. And there's even one for air purifiers for folks who live in an area where there's been wildfires and are maybe breathing in, you know, that air. I also spoke to Leandra Clark Harvey, who heads the advocacy group California Behavioral Health Association. And she said that she feels that if some of these get through, maybe that could provide a blueprint. Since it is kind of hard to tackle this as one big issue, maybe that could provide a blueprint for how legislators can tackle prior authorization piece by piece.
And potentially scale back unnecessary denials.
Exactly.
You learned a great deal in this series, Megan. What do you hope people take away from your series, even from people who will not experience menopause in their life?
Well, I mean, for one, I think it's pretty cool that we're talking about this. And I've really enjoyed that aspect of doing this project, talking about something that's maybe been a little taboo in the past, but is super important. And, you know, like you said, it affects half the population if we live long enough. On the flip side, I also think it's been really interesting doing this now because I think this would have been a completely different project maybe 5 or 10 years ago when maybe there were people talking about this, but there wasn't really, you know, legislation moving even in other parts of the country. And now we're kind of in a place where, you know, several of the people I talk to, they kind of start by saying, you know, menopause is having a moment. And it's been really cool to, you know, be an observer of that. So I think there's going to be a lot more coming out in the next years, just like how we weren't talking about periods much before, or the pink tax or other health topics that affect people with uteruses at different points. And this might be the next area where that's, you know, really changing.
Well, thank you so much, Megan, for sharing what you learned with us.
Thank you.
That is CAP Radio reporter Megan Myskowski sharing her series on the lack of research surrounding menopause and the medical field playing catch-up. This story is part of a series produced for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's California Health Equity Fellowship. But as far as Assembly Bill 432 is concerned, it just passed the Senate Business, Professions, and Economic Development Committee. It heads next to the Health Committee. If passed and signed into law, the measure directs the Medical Board in California to develop a curriculum ensuring doctors get up-to-date and standardized training for treating menopause. Still ahead, summer classes and the Sierra Buttes that are open to all ages. We'll learn more about the Sierra Nevada Field Campus. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.